My pleasure to welcome you to the Martin White Memorial Lecture. Martin White was a distinguished teacher of international relations whose career was encompassed by three institutions in the main: the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the LSE, and the University of Sussex. When he died, those three institutions organized a memorial lecture which rotates among them. And it's a pleasurable coincidence that the Martin White Memorial Lecture is being held here during the centenary year of the LSE. It's also a great pleasure to welcome Mrs. White and members of her family for this occasion. Our speaker this evening is Geoffrey Best, who has been Professor of History at the University of Edinburgh, and indeed when he was Professor of History, subsequently University of Sussex, he was the direct lineal successor of the late Martin White. And he works very much in his tradition, a tradition which has left a very important intellectual legacy at this school. Geoffrey Best has also had an association with the LSE, and he was for a time a visiting fellow at our Centre for International Studies. And we're also very pleased when his most recent book and well-received book, War and Law Since 1945, was actually launched at the school at the Centre for International Studies. It's my pleasure, therefore, to introduce Geoffrey Best, who's going to deliver the Martin White Memorial Lecture on the subject of justice in international relations, notes from the humanitarian and human rights underground.
Thank you, Professor Leifer. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. When I was a young man and just gone to the University of Edinburgh, a senior colleague with whom I was sharing a course said something which rather changed my life. John Mitchell, it was, the first holder of Edinburgh's pioneer chair of European government institutions. To my inquiry how I should begin to find out about a subject I felt I knew nothing about, he said, "Don't worry, Geoffrey, all you need is a point of entry." He showed me that point of entry and I went through it, and life wasn't as bad as I had feared. And I've been finding points of entry ever since. John Mitchell was quite right. They're all you need, provided you're willing to take on certain additional excitements and difficulties in life. And one of the difficulties, which I only really realized in preparing this lecture, is to find a point of exit. May I at once tell you that I have found no point of exit from the bundle of problems I've chosen to consider: the pursuit of justice within the global political system, in particular the two parts of that I know a little bit about, humanitarian law and human rights. I presumed to wrap the word justice around this bundle because that's its obvious contemporary indicator, but ethics is more exactly how it presented itself to me when 27 years or so ago I began to become fascinated by the problems of the relationship between ethics and war. I was such a novice in those studies when I began them in 1969 that I had squeezed quite a long way through my point of entry before I discovered rather a lot of people had gone through it already. And what most intrigued me was the existence of such a massive body of international law about the conduct of warfare. Under the name of the Law of Nations, the many principles and precedents were already well known to the educated classes of our continent by the 17th century. They were widely diffused through the European and American empires in the course of the 18th and 19th century, and became a universal institution in our own century. And to the history of this remarkable enterprise, I hopefully applied myself and set out to become, as best I could after 20 insular years, an international historian, which is how I came across Martin White. Now, you will expect me to say something about him, and readily do I so. but it can only be about his works and his influence, because it was not my good fortune to know him at first hand. I speak gladly of him now, because it was one of the few things he had published before he died that made my point of entry towards where I stand today. And the posthumous works which we owe to the loving labours of Hedley Bull, Carsten Holbrad, Brian Porter and Gabrielle White have only thickened my sense of debt to him. When I was just beginning to teach European history and had begun to hear of the existence of a discipline called international relations, I asked one of our brightest Europeanists at Edinburgh what to read for starters. Esmond Robertson it was, whom we kindly remembered by many of you here. Esmond at once said, read Diplomatic Investigations. So I found the book. I bought it, I now remember, and it was edited by Herbert Butterfield, whom I remembered from my Cambridge days, and Martin White, a name new to me. I read, I pondered, I was won over. Here was a way of writing about international relations which brought order out of chaos, and here was the outline of an international order of politics, law and values, which had, with luck, the power to survive the strains put upon it by those fractious members, the self-styled sovereign states, which had until then lined my mind's horizons. Now, anyone here who engages in the studies of politics, law, or history will understand what had happened. I had met Martin White's discovery that states, whenever and wherever they were fully formed and in continuing relations with each other, tended to behave regularly enough to constitute a system of states. I had met Hedley Bull's demonstration of how something had developed from that, which was sophisticated enough and self-conscious enough to merit the description of an international society, and how Grotius was its prophet. And I had met Herbert Butterfield's explorations of the ethical problems and paradoxes which press upon the persons responsible for working that system and maintaining that society. And I admit in all of them, and the others contributing to that remarkable book, a concern for justice. But it was justice in no common or comfortable clothes. It was a sense of justice inseparable from a sense of the morally ambiguous behavior of states and the justifications of raison d'etat, the mixedness of human nature, and the ultimate paradox that you could think that Antigone was right and wrong at the same time. Now, is Diplomatic Investigations, I wonder, a statist book? And am I a statist man? I put this question because the word statist has recently been used in a very excellent and exciting article, which some of you will have read, to describe persons, presumably like me, whose sympathies are chilled by giving the state too much attention and respect. And I refer to Professor Ken Booth's John Vincent Memorial Lecture delivered at Kiel last year and now published in the journal International Affairs. An excellent article, and I admit that his questions have bothered me. In fact, they made writing this lecture twice as difficult as it would otherwise have been. Because it's impossible not to share Ken Booth's well-expressed anxieties about the future, and it's very uncomfortable, therefore, not to be able heartily to share his views of what to do about it. Well, that's my situation, unfortunately, and I feel obliged to say why, because what I say about the humanitarian and human rights branches of international law will only make sense if his appraisal of the idea of state in international society is not quite right, and if my appraisal of it is not quite wrong. So let me summarize, to begin with, my principal points of difference. Now, Professor Booth maintains that realist obsession with the Westphalian state system has become a kind of dysfunctional fetishism, which is more than ripe for ditching. One may agree about the fetishism, but at the same time worry, lest we should forget, the hard truth, as I think, that at the heart of that system, the clarity with which it recognizes the role of power and allocates responsibility for wielding it is too important to pass by. Professor Booth loathes the vanity, self-deception, and collective selfishness inherent in the cult and cant of national sovereignty. Well, I loathe it too, and so did Martin White. No word that was once meaningful has become more misunderstood and misused than sovereignty. But to wean mankind, I might feel more optimistic about womankind, from knee-jerk nationalism to kindly cosmopolitanism, looks to me like a very long haul, with a lot of room for sentimental waste of effort and diversion of resources along the road. In one of several passages devoted to showing how bad the social condition of the world has become under the Westphalian system, Ken Booth says, "One always hopes for governments to act as local agents of the world common good, to use Hedley Bull's striking phrase, and occasionally one gets it, but not often. Power tends to corrupt, and this is a deadly combination with sovereignty. Even a good government, as they say in Featherstone, is still a bloody government." But, I would add, even a bloody government is better than no government. And I wonder what they say in Sierra Leone and in Afghanistan. I am not an anarchist, and I don't believe Ken Booth is either. I suggest he may have overstated the matter. The question remains then, how the management of the interests of the peoples of the world is to be done better than it has been to this date? Is there any promising alternative to its being done by or in partnership with the states in the system? For my part, I don't see how states or bodies, call them what you like, which do the same job as states, can be done without. I share Hedley Bull's belief that they can act on society's behalf, what we used to take for granted as the public interest. I even risk optimism to the extent of believing that some world trends of our time may be warming the hearts of those cold monsters. And that would be an agreeable sort of global warming. Now, finally, such differences of outlook between me and Ken Booth must be partly due to those unspoken assumptions, which I suppose were memorably brought to your attention by James Joll in this very hall 17 years ago. Ken Booth must be more of an optimist than Martin Whiteyans dare to be. More optimistic about the capabilities of socio-political engineering, and more trusting in, I won't say anything so question-begging as human nature, but I certainly dare say human nature in politics. Martin White and his friend Herbert Butterfield, incidentally, traditionally Christian in their thinking about these matters, would also have brought into play concepts of sin and judgment. And that returns to the point of entry to my theme today. Leaving aside the tricky question what may be the universal elements of human nature, there remains the interesting question, how much meaningful universality subsists in this international society that some of us talk about? And what is more than merely rhetorical in that stronger expression, which many of us use, the international community? Prima facie evidence of some sort of meaning is suggested by the quantity of interest currently directed towards anything called humanitarian, and by the intense interest taken by so many of us in the matter of human rights. Well, justice was the word I used in my title, and in its most literal sense, that's what I have in mind. But injustice is surely the heading under which most of us actually apprehend the matter in all its length and breadth. Beyond the administration of justice in the specific sense of the handling of crimes and punishments by legal persons, the achievement of universal justice in the sense of universally accepted and admired just arrangements of the affairs of mankind, that remains remote and theoretical. But injustice is close and practical. We have little doubt about our ability to know unjust arrangements when we see them. A variety of world-scale diagnoses of this condition is available, and Ken Booth's article helpfully includes a handy list of the most obvious of them. I quote from him, "Historical and contemporary theories which promote cosmopolitan values and ideas about human emancipation, all of them aspiring to building a humane global politics." It can be argued that standards and institutions appropriate to this great endeavour should logically follow the achievement of a humane global politics rather than precede it. That's something I'll come back to later. But either way, they belong with it, unless you suppose that the envisaged process of, to quote him again, cosmopolitanizing our sentiments, consciences, values, interests, horizons, behaviors, and ideologies can be so perfect as to dispense with the apparatus of laws and law enforcement central to the history of the modern state. Well, I turn now to international society's endeavors to move that apparatus to a higher plan, to make some reality of justice across borders. The obvious starting point is the international law construction boom, which came with the close of the Second World War. Almost every aspiration and promise of justice which has engaged our attention is affirmed or implied in the Charter of the UN and its accompanying rhetoric about peaceful progress towards a kinder, safer, and better off world. The two sectors of international law that I'm most concerned with were among the prominent beneficiaries of this construction boom. And before going any further, I must clear up misunderstandings about this word, humanitarian. It has come into common use to cover every sort of benevolent sentiment and activity towards suffering persons in foreign parts, with accompanying overlap between it and the better observance of human rights. But in the terminology of international law and organization, the meanings of humanitarian and human rights are discrete and independent. And humanitarian law, a term invented in the 1950s and popularized by the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, has become the term more and more used to describe what had always previously been called the laws of war or the laws of armed conflict. Now, some of us have regretted this as a misleading misnomer. Serious employments of armed force may not be susceptible of humanization, and the suggestion that they can be may encourage a state of mind unsuited to constructive thought about resort to armed force and the price that has to be paid for it. Moreover, it's obviously rather confusing that the same word is used for the branch of international law which legitimizes the infliction of death and damage, and for the branch of international organization which aims to prevent death and damage. And confusion is perfected by the fact that supposedly non-political humanitarian aid is often seen to go to participants in armed conflicts and is reckoned by competent judges sometimes to protract those conflicts. And yet the word can hardly be avoided in connection with my bundle of issues. And I meant to have inverted commas round it in the poster which has brought you here, and I'm sorry they don't appear. Perhaps you can hear them in my voice as I mention it. These inverted commas would have signalized to you that I was using it as a term of legal art. And what perhaps I can simplify the matter by using the expression memorably introduced by the famous International Commission of Jurists, Sean McBride, in 1968, human rights in armed conflicts. Let's take humanitarian law as meaning human rights in armed conflicts. Well, humanitarian law in this sense was well ahead of human rights law in its claim to extend the effective realm of international justice. That extension can be considered under three heads. First, the war crimes trials, preeminent among them, the international military tribunals of Nuremberg and Tokyo. Now, I ought to say the so-called international tribunals, because one can slip into supposing that the word international made them as meaningfully international as is, for example, the International Court of Justice at The Hague, or as must be the tribunal currently authorized by the Security Council to deal with alleged war crimes in Yugoslavia. The Nuremberg Tribunal was set up by the common will of the four leading victor states and later adhered to by 19 other states, and it was to apply international law. In the event, it made a bit of international law too. Together with its counterpart in Tokyo and the hundreds of, so to speak, ordinary trials which were conducted by military courts in occupied or liberated territories, the total experience was felt to establish a powerful base for the enforcement of, at any rate, that part of international law through all time to come. And that base appeared to be strengthened by two other innovations of the same years. the much enlarged Geneva Conventions of 1949, contained common articles denominating certain war crimes as grave breaches of the conventions, necessarily to be punished as such. And the innovation here was that was the virtually unprecedented provision for universal jurisdiction, that is, for the arrest and prosecution of alleged committers of grave breaches in whatever country they might be found, whether or not it was the one where the crime had been committed. And if a signatory state didn't wish to do the job itself, it was bound to hand the accused over to a state that did. Then there was the third piece of landmark legislation from that time, the Genocide Convention of 1948, adopted nem. con. By the General Assembly as a means to stigmatize the peculiar awfulness of what Nazi Germany had tried to do to Gypsies and Jews, and to prevent the same thing happening again. A convention only just a little bit blunted by its optimistic expectation that signatory states, the most conceivable authorizers of the crime, would prosecute their own agents for committing it. Now, with the grim matter of genocide, we move into the borderland shared with human rights. Human rights, let us recall, were launched upon the world between 1945 and 48. The UN Charter unfurled their banner, and one of the organization's first concerns was to set up a commission and a directorate to carry the matter fast forward. And the outcome of that was the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted by the General Assembly the day after the Genocide Convention in December 1948. This was, of course, an event of enormous importance, and I'm only not going to go into it just now, because it actually didn't contain or mention any machineries of inspection and enforcement. They were to come a few years later. Well, the international law of war was ahead of it, by 1950, far ahead in that respect. Well, now let's see what came of those bold innovations. How effective turned out to be their means of supervision and enforcement. First, as to the great war crimes trials, Nuremberg and Tokyo, they remain like great signs in the sky with very little going on earth beneath them. Their full meaning and significance, I believe, is not well understood. One of the popular understandings of them has been as symbols of how winners in war could deal with losers. I recall reading in the mid or later 60s of a Zairean demand that Mr. Chombi of Katanga, who had got away to somewhere on the Mediterranean coast of Africa, should be brought back to Zaire, quote, for a Nuremberg trial. A Nuremberg trial, I thought. Well, that's how our noble exercise in international justice is understood in less scrupulous societies. And yet, of course, there was self-deception among ourselves about those much-trumpeted tribunals. An early and very good book about the Tokyo Tribunal was titled Victor's Justice. Nuremberg wasn't free from the same taint, and it was gratifying to people like me, a young man at that date, that the accused on their way to being found guilty, as I assume they all would be, should be publicly exposed to obloquy and scorn. Great was my surprise when not all of the accused were found guilty and many of them escaped the death penalty. Great has been my relief as the vengeful emotions of youth gave way to the milder thoughts of middle age to conclude that although some injustice was done and some justice that might have been done was not done, a great deal of justice was done at Nuremberg and Tokyo and at all the other war crimes trials after 1945. And I hope much good done too in the sense of a wholesome effect on the collective moral sense of our species. And yet one cannot help wondering now that war crimes have again become a fashionable talking point and international war crimes trials are actually likely to be held, after so many occasions when there was good cause for holding them and nothing happened. One can't help wondering whether they may not do harm as well as good. Nuremberg and Tokyo, for sure, can't be invoked on their behalf. Leaving aside their questionable inventions of crimes against peace and conspiracy to commit aggression, and sticking to their most defensible aspect in relation to crimes against humanity and war crimes proper, we must note they were held in unique circumstances. They could only be held as they were held because Germany and Japan lay prone beneath the victor's feet, as few vanquished states had been before or since. There was no German or Japanese state in existence at the end of the war. Unconditional surrender was what the victorious Allies had demanded, and they had got it. Such unique circumstances made it possible to detain and hold for trial everyone the victors chose to lay their hands on and could do so. Thus, that singular feature of the Nuremberg Charter, the fact that a person who committed an act which constitutes a crime under international law acted as head of state or responsible government official, does not relieve him from responsibility under international law. This was what helped to make Nuremberg morally satisfying and what still helps to incline the scales of judgment in its favour. They brought to judgment not just the usual small fry who might plead they'd only obeyed orders, but also those who had given the orders or allowed them to be given. The trouble with following this Nuremberg precedent is that circumstances like those don't often occur. And when they do, to the same extent that heads of state and government are available for trial, it's usually because of internal upsets of some sort, a civil war or a revolution. We recently saw in respect of Iraq, and we are now seeing in respect of Yugoslavia, the vanity and imprudence of preparing to fry your fish before you've caught them. The Iraqi state apparatus remained after the cessation of hostilities very much as it had been before. The revolution or coup that might just conceivably have delivered Saddam Hussein for trial never happened. More embarrassing still is it to find that ethnic chieftains in former Yugoslavia, who were previously denounced as war criminals and orders of genocide, now have to be negotiated with as the only persons capable of delivering ceasefires and even peace settlements. This all does seem a long way away from the ideals and principles of 1945. Experience of the working of the Geneva Conventions has similarly taken us a long way from 1945. I pointed out a few minutes ago how novel was their provision for universal extraterritorial jurisdiction. States were supposed to catch hold of those accused of breaching the convention and hand them back. This was a point in which the Geneva Convention's provisions for justice were, to begin with, thought very superior to those of the Hague Convention of 1907, because the makers of the Hague rules took it for granted that their enforcement was a matter for states to decide in relation to national policy and for action in their own national courts. Action or inaction. This is exactly how humanitarian law has been implemented since the post-war wave of it thinned down to its trickling aftermath. Until genocide and other ghastliness in former Yugoslavia and Rwanda compelled this recent risky revival of Nuremberg-ish proceedings, one could have said that state practice regarding the pursuit of international humanitarian justice had simply been to de-internationalize it. No state is known willingly to have extradited any alleged war criminal unless it suited national policy and did not upset national public opinion. States are not known to have prosecuted enemy war criminals unless they could do so with perfect political safety. The ambitious Indian and Bangladeshi project to prosecute over 200 Pakistani alleged war criminal prisoners in the early 70s foundered in a morass of hostage dealing and realpolitik. And hardly any state is known to have prosecuted any of its own servicemen, let alone ex-servicemen or civilian officials, in respect of classic war crimes. The only case of any significance is that of Lieutenant Calley from 1971. And, as law officers of the United States Armed Forces delight to point out, what Calley was explicitly charged with was not an offence against any part of international law, but a breach of his nation's uniform code of military justice. Now, the point may seem trivial, inasmuch as that code of justice mirrors the Hague and Geneva rules. But in other than legal perspectives, it is not trivial, because it shows how national rather than international principles of action are preferred, even when it would be easy to take credit for honouring an international obligation. Well, my last reflection about humanitarian law is regretfully to wonder whether the high principle pursuit of a rather literal reading of justice actually promotes good international relations. There are several ways in which one may doubt it. I don't refer to the queasiness we feel at knowing that the big fish will swim free, while we are said to be the better off for catching and frying a few small ones at enormous expense per head. Admittedly, the costs and inefficiencies of any system of justice make one feel that way. But the criminal trials we are now considering are not to be appraised by the same standards as common criminalities of peacetime. These are events of international moral concern, because within the framework of society as we know it, the interests of humankind at large are involved. War crimes trials may serve as indicators of the degree of humanitarian law's success in doing what is expected of it, preventing the standards of civilization from lapsing when wars can't be prevented from happening. The philosophy of these events, then, posits not just respectful attention from the people whose belligerent record has been on trial. It also posits the attention of the peoples who have been belligerent on the other side and whose record has only not been similarly exposed because they ended up on the winning side. Let me get off this topic by hazarding a comparison of the effects of Nuremberg and Tokyo on the public minds, respectively, of the defendant peoples and, as it were, the plaintiffs. Did those protracted proceedings serve to encourage German and Japanese understandings of what had been unacceptable in their respective political cultures? I have the impression, no more than that, that Nuremberg and its offspring must have had some part in prompting German recognition of what had gone wrong with their country and making possible that remarkable series of occasions when presidents and others have expressed collective regret. Regarding Japan, my impression, only that, is that the war crimes trials in that hemisphere cannot have worked so well to the same internationally desirable end. My conclusion about the trial's effects on the defendants, therefore, is mixed. But my conclusion, not at all mixed, regarding the trial's effects on us plaintiffs. The purposes of the tribunals, after all, were not just juridical, they were also educational. And I can't see that they did much to educate the British and American peoples. Circumstances made it inevitable that the spotlights would play only in the direction of the losers, where indeed there was plenty to play on, and that what the victors had done should therefore remain in the shadows. Not so inevitable was it that discussion of what the victors had done should remain as much in the shadows as it did until recently. A good deal more reflection of the but for the grace of God variety and more interest in finding out why such awful things happened at all might have caused more of us to ponder on the moral muddle which the legal process bypassed. Black and white moral judgment was encouraged, I think, by the legal alternatives of guilty or not guilty. The verdict of not proven was not on offer. The defensive plea of tu quoque, you too, was forbidden by the rules of the court, and although the ghost of it couldn't be banished, the effect of the banning was to suppress subsequent frank talk in the victorious countries about the areas where both sides had done similar things, as they very much had in the matters of bombing and submarine warfare. I wonder whether things are changing. The wide-ranging debate within the past few years about how to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of the war and so on seems to me to have registered lower than hitherto on the righteousness scale. And the way the Dresden commemorations of 4 weeks ago were discussed, even in the popular press, suggested that we may at last have acquired the ability to take in other points of view besides our own, and to understand that the alternative to not feeling guilty about awful events is not necessarily to feel good about them. This, if popularly absorbed, would mark a notable improvement on the military side of our culture, sap the strength of some of the flattering myths so dear to our patriotic nationalist hearts, and perhaps make the bellicose of us less so. Well, now, humanitarian law needed a special introduction because it used the word in a special sense. Human rights, to which I now turn, needs no introduction. It's become a dominant idea in the world since its inception in that legislative boom around 1945 to 50. And it's the lingua franca in which most of the aches and pains of international society are discussed. The rights of individuals came first to the minds of many of us, but collective rights of several kinds are big, too, in the human rights vocabulary. Minority rights, solidarity rights, development rights, and, biggest one of all, the right of popular self-determination. So generously has the Human Rights Project taken under its wing all the important aspirations of humankind. It includes by now virtually everything that disinterested universal benevolence can dream of. Now, not much of all that is human rights law in the strict sense, which means if you don't obey it, you get judgment and punishment in its wake. Within the umbrella of all this soft law, as it's called, is a sturdy trunk and branches of hard law, international human rights law considered to be observable here and now, and equipped with institutions of supervision and judgment to make sure that it is observed. And if we're looking for the spread of justice in the world, this, if anywhere, is where it's going to be found. And this, alas, is where we don't find much of it. For if we inquire, what is the health of this original core of human rights, the civil and political rights for which institutions of inspection and judgment have been provided to some extent, we are promptly made aware by every day's international news and the reports of every human rights organization that much is continually done which ought not to be done, and much is not done which ought to be done. Why is this? Why is state practice in this respect so contrasting with state professions? And what remains of our idea of international society, let alone international community, when its primary members behave like this? I began to be made to think about this phenomenon when I was working on my book about humanitarian law since 1945. My conclusion was the rather superficial one that states simply didn't seem to be serious about the commitments they entered into. I suggested it made a bit of sense of it if one viewed those commitments as relatively costless gestures of appeasement of humanitarian public sentiment. And I added, hoping further to explain the unseriousness, that the rules they publicly committed themselves to were, if truth be told, sometimes rather impractical or fanciful. Such were the results of my inquiries into the field of humanitarian law. Now I'm going to follow a similar line of inquiry into human rights law, offering a few suggestions as to why so many difficulties stand in the way of its, so to speak, official implementation. End up with wondering whether the underground alternatives that I'll come to at the end can do better. What then are the difficulties which help to explain states' failures to honour their overt commitments? Difficulty number one, the statist viewpoint, which has been there since day one. I put it, we are sovereign states and proud of it. International society is made up of sovereign states which manage without external interference their internal affairs. We know that international society in its formative centuries expected of its members a certain standard of civilization. We also know that the Charter and its standard-setting progeny suggest we should conduct our internal affairs by such and such a standard. But how we do it is our business, not yours. See the Charter, Article 2, Paragraph 7. All that the anti-statist can reply is that such pride of sovereignty is or ought to be a thing of the past, and that the spirit of the Charter requires Article 2, Paragraph 7, to be taken in a more relaxed manner. Second difficulty, the constitutional paradox, which dovetails with the statist difficulty and has been there since the creation. The civil and political rights and fundamental freedoms asserted by human rights law are very largely rights to be exercised against state power. Yet it is state power itself which is expected to protect those rights. To Western Democrats like you and me, with political cultures formed in British and American modes, this is no problem. Our states exist for the human beings composing them, not vice versa. The exercise of state power is legitimized by restriction to hands that can be called to account. The rule of law through an independent judiciary is a commonly valued principle, and on the whole it works. But try telling all that to persons in lands where state power is more a possession than a trust, where democracy is, to put it mildly, a tender shoot, and where the rule of law nothing but a snare and a delusion. Then there are the revisionists, who have only recently articulated their objection, and a real facer this is if you take it seriously. The Charter, quite obviously, and the Universal Declaration, not much less so if you apply a bit of biblical criticism to it, were products of their age and bear the stamp of that age's obsessions. Any international instrument produced in 1945 couldn't but be motivated by fear and loathing of fascism. Anything similar produced in 1948 was going to pick up fear and loathing of communism. Consideration of those characteristics of the age and others that I'll come to may prompt the question, if the Charter and the Universal Declaration were to be written now, they wouldn't read like that, would they? Fourth, the Western values charge. This is, of course, also revisionist, but it's been there from the start. The political history and the negotiating history of the Universal Declaration show how fragile the universality originally was. And it's more fragile still if you recall what continents and cultures were not even there to join in the negotiations. My assessment is that non-Western dislike of Western values only didn't impinge more or earlier on us because for so long the Western alliance perceived its main opponent to be the values of communism and therefore neglected other opponents that it might also find incompatible. Specifically, communist values do seem by now to be out of the competition. It's too early to say whether collectivist values generally have gone too. But even if they have, there's more than enough for the upholders of Western values to worry about in the objections being quite aggressively made by, to take the most conspicuous, popular and revolutionary Islam's allegations of secularism and materialism, the Asian Tigers' defense of what they say are culturally distinctive notions of state authority, and African expositions of traditional modes of social cohesion, effective representation, and political decision-making. Now, being in some way Western, of course, doesn't disqualify a value from being universal. I stand with those who believe that there are universal human rights and that our core human rights are among them. But I've been driven by these recent challenges to wonder whether we can be very comfortable or complacent about it. Let me put the case for a bit of limited revisionism. I can't deny that the core of our idea of human rights is in some sense individualist or individualistic. I don't wish to deny it because I think it can be vindicated. In that sense, I think that the ideal at the heart of our idea of human rights is universal, but with this should come some discomfort. For many of the individuals who are conspicuous and admired in our Western societies are not actually ones I would be eager to introduce and recommend to others. They make me wonder, even here in one of the cultures from which the human rights idea took off, whether we've actually got its ideals properly in focus. Has something gone wrong? Has something got lost along the way? Looking outwards, I adopt the Marxian question. Do we want to belong to an international society which would take us as models? Now, at the bottom of this discomfort is the question, what is human life about? The major human rights instruments invite this question. Their lists of personal, civil, and political rights are headed by the right to life. And they go on to list fundamental rights and freedoms which suggest the things that might be expected to go on in this life to which a right is basic. Each of us would express differently the philosophy herein contained, and I just offer a little summary of it, hoping I'm not off the mark. This scheme of rights and freedoms is to enable individuals to become and to be fully themselves, to fulfill capabilities, exercise talents, and so on, by volition from inside, not by pressure from without. the assumption being that each of us is a moral being, distinctive and unique. When the human rights speak, as they repeatedly do, of the human being, they mean the unique human individual. Not exclusively a Western concept, I hasten to say. And what they are doing is clearing the path, following the path cleared in Anglo-American constitutional history, liberating adult individuals from compulsion as to what they shall believe in the way of religion. They are affirming that society and the state can hold together without religious and ideological uniformity. And they are siding with the political philosophies which assert that the state is made for us, not vice versa. Three corollaries follow. One, the right to, I now quote from the International Covenant, freedom of thought, conscience and religion is fundamental and absolute. Call it Western or not as you choose, it's integral to the idea of this unique human individual. Now this right and this idea are incompatible with any religion which equates the rule of law with the rules of religion and denies to those born into that religion the right to depart from it. This right was first formulated precisely to protect persons against that sort of spiritual dictatorship in Christian lands, and there are obvious difficulties, I put it no more strongly, about its acceptability in Muslim lands now. Corollary two. This human rights philosophy regards women as no less distinctive, unique, and mentally capable than men. Human rights law asserts the equality of the sexes. To affirm that equality as absolute was the purpose of one of its most comprehensive instruments, the 1979 Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, passed by the General Assembly unanimously, 130 in favour, none against, 10 abstentions. Not such good news is that those acceptances were accompanied by a mass of reservations wherein states signalised their true feelings and practical intentions. Third corollary, there are relativities and relationships to be considered as well as the absolutes which I've so far focused. Society, group and state rights are not absent even from Western human rights codes. And although it's fair enough to say that their primary concern is the protection of individuals' rights, I give notice that I'll later touch on the all-important matter of the relationships between the individual and the group, between rights which conflict with one another, and between the relativities thus called into play. Now let's glance at the question whether, at this time when there's open disagreement about the very fundamentals of human rights law, justice is getting it anywhere on this side of international society. First, a quick sketch of the institution set up to pursue it. The scene is quite unlike that of humanitarian law. The human rights scene is of an intermingling multiplicity of institutions, none of which is in itself of great grandeur, but which together add up to a great deal. And please note, I'm looking for the universal, not the regional. Regional would be a much simpler matter. And the European Convention and so on, standing nearby to give us encouragement. But I'm looking for the universal, a much more difficult thing. I think I'll skip, because I don't want to keep you beyond where you might expect to be going, skip with the little bit I was going to say about the idea of an international court of criminal justice, which has popped up again after many decades what is it that hedgehogs do in the winter? That's right, yes, it's popped up again. But I really don't think that it's worth looking at, because it's not going to get anywhere. Now, between that, but it is that represents the idea of a supranational stratum of administration of justice. Now, between that and the national apparatus of institutions on which international law relies for the implementation of its rules and standards, between that ideal top and the actual national bottom, there is a rich variety of institutions and officials beavering away to improve the observance of these rules and standards, and undoubtedly doing so to good effect. Most impressive of these are the Human Rights Commission and the Human Rights Committee. The Commission's been there from the beginning, and for many years now, it has been authorising and publishing the results of inquiries, both into particular scandals and abuses and into scandals and abuses in particular countries. The Human Rights Committee came into existence to conduct regular checks on the performance of the states which became party to the 1966 Covenant, and to hear complaints about each other by states which were willing to go one step further. That committee, among whose 18 members, by the way, has served your distinguished Professor of International Law, is the foremost and firmest example of a type of institution found in many parts of the human rights firmament. A monitoring body established by virtue of a UN standard-setting resolution, authorized to advise and comment on its observance. And a glance among any of the periodicals which regularly surveys the flow among these channels of human rights surveillance will show you how much pressure is being put on all the time this way. It's impossible not to believe some of it must be successful. And yet, again, and yet, so much of the work of justice is evidently not being done. For the problem, you see, is not just the silly sovereignty one, nor just that some states expressly object to UN-approved norms. It is that some states which appear in the lists are signatories of the Civil and Political Rights Covenant, for example, appear also on Amnesty International's list of states which practice torture. Pride of sovereignty, the self-interest of rulers and ruling classes, cultural habits and administrative inertia altogether choke human rights progress along the lines where the internationalist most expects to find it. With relief and a renewal of hope, therefore, I turn to see whether there may not be more nationally based means of working towards the same end. Now, it is of human rights national, not human rights NGOs, that's non-governmental organizations, and truth commissions that I'm going to speak in my last passages, and of their place in this great scheme. All the central points of the human rights scheme, of course, end up somewhere around the UN, and NGOs can easily seem to be importers of norms and standards into states from the great international outside. Nothing wrong with that, given that states are supposed to respect international law. But no need to go on about it. Respect for the human rights side of all this law is patchy and grudging. And it is politically intelligible that there should be difficulties, because the very principle on which states are constituted contains, as I've already said, germs of resistance to human rights pressure group demands. That resistance may not ipso facto always be unreasonable. And the proponents of state authority might, in the last resort, be pushed into a position where they ask the human rights absolutist, "What will remain of your plans for a rights-based society in the event that your demands help to dissolve the state which alone could sustain it?" Now, if we're in any doubt about the extent to which humanitarian and human rights law do not meet with universal applause and acceptance, the World Conference on Human Rights at Vienna in mid-1993 must have settled the question. I do not know whether to laugh or cry at the extent to which its published outcome, the Vienna Declaration and Programme of Action, obscures the tough facts with fine phrases. Not so much at that conference itself, where the representatives of states were, so to speak, on their best behaviour, but in the many preliminary regional gatherings, in what was reported from outside the conference hall, and in what has been said and written copiously since, resistance to human rights progress and even a confident sort of counterattack upon human rights have been unmistakable. In the light of these, the universal reign of justice seems very remote. The question is a very complicated one, and it requires inquiry into how far the leaven and the ferment of human rights can be made acceptable in societies where some of them are unfamiliar and may be thought threatening. And threatening not just to those statists who can be relied on to come out with very unattractive expressions of fear and dislike, but also to those needy and hopeful groups and masses for whom human rights are meant to be good. Do you think that a decent Indian peasant paterfamilias will really bless the bundle of rights which will enable his family to watch soap operas made in California or sex films from Holland? With that imagined poor Indian, I return to the question of cosmopolitanization, which Professor Booth calls me to face. Something of this sort is probably integral to the prospect of the universal implementation of human rights. But how far and how fast can it go? I was astounded to read in last Tuesday's Independent that Comandante Marcos of the Mexican Zapatistas talks to us through his laptop computer and cyberspace. I thought, there's cosmopolitanization for you. But in general, surely, the national and local perspectives, which throughout history have been habitual for the mass of humankind, remain so. And not least, are plenty of laptop users in this country. And much difficulty do they make for the elites and progressive-minded minorities who wish to get moving in the cosmopolitan direction. This cosmopolitanization of our mentalities, in which Ken Booth puts his trust, doubtless must happen if the global reign of justice is to get anywhere. I dare say all of us in this hall lend a hand to hasten it. We shall only differ about the means for hastening it and the expected time schedule. Now, why this matters so much to my theme is because the establishment of machineries of justice in a world of imperfect cosmopolitanization is putting carts before horses. I'll sum up in the words of someone who does it much better than I can do, the professor of law, international law, who seems to me to have said the most sensible things about international relations in this century, and that's James Brierley, who was professor at Oxford between about 1924 and 1948. At the end of a lecture in 1944, he said, people were wrong to complain that international law hadn't produced a peaceful world. You mustn't, he said, ask of law what law of itself can't give. Quote, law and order is a familiar phrase, but really it inverts the true order of priority. For it is never law that creates order. It's true that when order has once become the rule of a society, then, if some threat to it arises, law may be found to have acquired a prestige which may convert it into a powerful instrument for defending the threat. But always order has to exist before there can even be a soil for law to take root and grow in. And there's the main point of my lecture. Before international society's law can be appreciated in its member societies, their national soils must be prepared and proved to be receptive. And that is primarily a business for insiders, not outsiders. National NGOs may indeed welcome support from outside, and it's certainly true that the members of some national NGOs are only safe while outside visitors are there to protect them against the nastiness that their own state would thrust upon them. But the spade work on national soil must be done by insiders, because no others can do it without giving the peculiar sort of offence characteristic of Nosey Parker and Mrs. Pardigal, the deracine cosmopolitan and the cultural imperialist. Now you may be saying, so what's new? Non-intervention has long been an intensively worked over topic in international relations. Humanitarian intervention has been the flavour of the last few years. The human rights aspect of justice in international relations was the very subject of a good book only 9 years ago by no less a scholar than John Vincent, whose opinion of my ventures onto his patch I should have valued more than anyone else's if he had been spared to give it. But he did not, as a matter of fact, concern himself closely with the UN's human rights program and its implementation. Let me now show how, notwithstanding the weaknesses of the, so to speak, official international organs of humanitarian and human rights justice, the cause is being served in ways one might not have expected. First, those human rights NGOs. I'm thinking not just of the famous international ones, but of those which are primarily national and locally rooted. Taken together, these organizations, where the human rights foot soldiers run the risks and face the fire in the front line, can be numbered in thousands. The 900 NGOs, which were well connected enough to send 3,000 representatives to the Vienna Conference in 93, were the tiny apex of a pyramid, bulging with, I now quote the Secretary General's figures of 6 months ago, 10,000 in Bangladesh and 27,000 in Chile. They form a transnational network, one might say a human rights international, with two characteristics relevant to my argument. First, they are primary examples of the way cosmopolitanizing forces can operate within international society, but outside the state system. And as such, they've been active and influential enough, slightly to dent the state's historic monopoly of the panel of international legal personae. Secondly, they tend by their nature to be up against that system and the sovereign states which love it. For these reasons, I come to think of them as an underground, beavering away, often quite inconspicuously, and raising a ferment among the assumptions and customs of the societies in which they are situated. Therefore, working towards that end, which is to be most desired, cultural change innovated organically from within, rather than implanted from without. I mention that latter possibility because so much was made of it by the Asian Tiger States in the run-up to Vienna, and something similar is said by some African writers. Now, I leave the NGOs with that because I only want to keep you another 6 minutes. With the Truth Commissions, which were pioneered in Latin America, we have a different sort of institution, which is not so much underground as roundabout. Now, the Truth Commissions were invented 10 years or so ago in Latin America to secure an unconventional kind of qualified justice in post-war situations where conventional and unqualified justice were unattainable. These extraordinary situations occurred when military regimes, on relinquishing power, made sure they got amnesties for all the wrong that they are alleged to have done, and so they were shielded from criminal investigations. That's the military men and their police and civil collaborators, after winning their more or less dirty wars, should make way for elected civilian administrations was good. Not so good was it that their price for doing so was, the word has become notorious, impunity with regard to their breaches of humanitarian and human rights law. And I won't go into the complicated question of which was the more applicable when and where. Now, those brave and persistent Argentinian mothers of the disappeared, who became well known to us through the 80s, were only one element of the transnational network of protesting groups which argued that civil society could not self-respectingly resume until the purifying processes of justice had been seen to happen. That demand, with which one emotionally yearned to agree, has everywhere proved impossible to meet, and I'd like to wonder whether the reasons are all bad. Only a few trials ever took place. Had the post-military governments attempted to follow the maxim, fiat justitia, ruat caelum, let justice happen, though the heavens fall, had they attempted to do that, nothing would have happened but the return of repression and civil strife. The case has been made that a moral price was worth paying for the definitive closure of that bad era of military coups and human wrongs. And I wonder whether presidents and prime ministers were necessarily such weak or bad men when they concluded that general amnesties qualified by the findings of truth and, hopefully, reconciliation commissions held the best promise for the peace of the country. But those men and women who nevertheless went on with conducting, as it were, private truth commissions and publishing results without any government encouragement must have been very brave and just-minded. Well, those Latin American precedents are being followed in South Africa and will no doubt be followed in other countries. Doing what can be done in the cause of justice and peace and, which the pursuit of justice on its own can rarely bring, reconciliation. The exposure of crimes without prospect of conventional punishment is hoped to be less likely to breed intractable resentments more likely even to encourage repentance, that repentance by wrongdoers without which reconciliation is unreasonable, and an unrelieved sense of grievance by the wronged all too understandable. Alas, my study of truth commissions to date does not encourage me to think they are being successful in this respect, which is the more of a pity, since nothing can more probably diminish hostile feelings between groups and openness about the wrongs they have done one another. Not just the temptation to believe that everything the victorious allies did was therefore right, but also that the many expressions of contrition made by German public persons, not least Presidents von Weizsäcker and Herzog at Dresden only last week, concerning the criminal policies their country followed in the Nazi time. I was thinking also of Pope John Paul's various expressions of regret for the Church's past attitudes towards Jewry and Israel, and of the Spanish hierarchy's expression in 1960-something of contrition for its one-sidedness during the Spanish Civil War. Admissions of this kind, I believe, do more good than almost anything else to promote national self-knowledge and to awaken that sensitivity about justice in international relations which is my special concern today. At any rate, they seem unlikely to do the harm which war crimes trials sometimes bring with them. And I conclude with six summarizing propositions. One, international society is a sensible and serviceable way of describing the human universe we live in. Between it and us, states are the normal intermediate and executive bodies, and it's impossible to see how they or their like can be dispensed with. Two, the expression international community nicely describes the direction we would like our international society to move in, but it can promote misunderstanding when political fundamentals like the exercise of power and the application of laws are in discussion. Three, the laws devised in the last generation to enforce the rules of conduct in war and to implement human rights are shown by experience to have been over-ambitious. Some of them appear to require revision, or perhaps just a rephrasing, to restore their universal credibility. Four, in any case, the secure implementation of human rights laws and norms may depend as much on their becoming accommodated to the norms and practices of non-Western societies as on the norms and practices of non-Western societies becoming accommodated to them. Five, the bad behavior of states is not the only obstacle to the implementation of human rights. Questions of priorities and adjustments deserve to be taken seriously. The Anglo-American package of rights and freedoms has a few dodgy items in it. Six, and finally, the advancement of the cause of human rights, like the pursuit of justice regarding war criminals, does not exclude considerations of prudence, and prudence, equally with justice, was one of the seven virtues.
Can I thank you for what's been an intellectual feast? The subject of justice in international relations is tangled and complex, and it's very easy to be either righteous or cynical, and you were neither. I thank you for the sensitivity with which you addressed the subject, and I'm pleased also with the optimism with which you finished your lecture. Thank you very much indeed.